The History of African Americans in Maine. As Maine marks its bicentennial, we look back on how the state was shaped by its people. That review of history often misses the stories and contributions of Black Mainers, people who have lived here since the first settlers arrived on our shores. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me to learn how African Americans in Maine have been part of our state's evolution, whether they were brought here as slaves or came here for work, family, or education. They've made their mark in the military, maritime trades, religion, the arts, politics, and more. The history of our state, traced through the experience of the Black people who have lived here over the centuries. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. The history of Black Mainers is not well known, in large part because the stories of their lives were hardly documented over the centuries. Today, we'll learn about the efforts that have been made to capture the history of the African Americans who have had a lasting impact on our state. This show is part of Maine Calling's exploration of topics relating to Maine's bicentennial. Joining me in the studio, Patricia Wall. She's the author of the book Lives of Consequence, Blacks in Early Kittery and Berwick in the Massachusetts Province of Maine. And Bob Green, writer and contributor to the book Maine's Visible Black History, the First Chronicle of Its People. He teaches Maine's Black History at the University of Southern Maine's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. As always, we'd love to hear from you. Did you ever learn anything about Black history in Maine in school? Have you heard stories about any African-American Mainers who have made their mark here? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to both of you, and I'm eager to talk about your research, but I wanted to first address a question that I think a lot of listeners have about terminology. Both of your books refer to the history of Blacks in Maine, and rather than saying Black people or the term African-American or other phrases, Patricia, can you just kind of clarify how you went about choosing the terminology?
Well, in my research, I noticed that there were indigenous people or American Indians, and there were Blacks, Africans who'd been brought into the area as enslaved. And then there were also mixed people of mixed heritage. And so as I looked at the whole group, I settled on the term Black for all of them.
I see. And Bob, you know, as over the years, the terms, the accepted terms have changed. And
yes, I attended I was at a conference in Kansas City, Missouri, a number of years ago when I first heard the term African-American, and I was alone in fighting it because all of a sudden I lost several members of my family, aunt who happened to be born in Jamaica. So she really wasn't an African-American. She was a African-Jamaican and other people. So I prefer the term Black. And in my course that I teach at University of Southern Maine, I tell my students that sometimes I will say African-American, but most of the time I will use the terminology Black.
Okay, thank you for the explanation. And Patricia, what we talked about early, right off the bat, was that in the history books, we learn about white history. When we go online and try to look things up, that's where we turn to learn about history. But it turns out when you wanted to learn more about the history of Blacks in Maine, there really wasn't much to reference. The lives of Black people went unrecorded. So what did you do?
Well, even further than that, we are oriented from the earliest years that Black history is all South. And so more and more, I became aware of New England's Black history. And in the 90s, I was writing a story about the white children in the Warner House in Portsmouth, and met Valerie Cunningham, who's become an eminent historian in the Portsmouth area, and she shared some of her research with me. So I said goodbye to the white children, that we had lots of information about them, and began looking at bringing together a fictional black family set in the late 18th century. But the historical background is spot on in terms of what happened to them. And so it was a need to emphasize introducing young people to New England's early black history and bring the story north. And so further than that, then, when the first Congregational Church in Kittery Point was about to celebrate its 300th anniversary of its building, I thought perhaps I could contribute something by trying to locate maybe some of the black people who were isolated to the galleries in such churches. But I soon discovered that because of the nature of the documents, I had to research the entire early parish of Kittery from Kittery Point clear on through the Berwicks.
And so newspapers rarely mentioned blacks. They were not visible in historic documents. They were maybe recorded in birth certificates or...
Not at all.
Not even there. So you refer to it as scattered bits. How did you find these bits?
It's so scattered, you never know when you're going to come across it.
It's a detective
you
search.
You literally have to read everything about a given locale, all the diaries, the letters, everything. And what's interesting is that the early historians... mostly they looked at probate records. So they got a skewed impression of slavery because they saw the person, their financial situation at the end of their life, but they didn't see it at the beginning. And so it gives you a whole eye-opener as to the presence of enslaved people.
And so you basically piece together these little mentions here and there of names in, you know, in passing, and recreated the fact that there were more than 400 people of black.
Oh, it easily could have been double that.
In the Kittery area, just in southern Maine during that period, the colonial period.
I could document somewhere in the neighborhood between 400 and 500 people.
So if you extrapolate from that, does that mean that the numbers, the estimates of the percentage of black Mainers of that era are probably way off?
Well, I think so. There's so many reasons why people were not counted. Census records did not count children. Anyone under 14 or over 40 was not counted. And oftentimes there was no effort to take them to church for baptism. There are only scattered a very few church records in the area where a slave owner brings along his enslaved person to be baptized.
Oh, we'll get to that in a moment because you have some stories where you did find records. So let's hold that thought. And Bob, I just want to get to you too because you also did a lot of digging in order to find, and I guess it started as a personal family search.
It did. My oldest son one time asked me if we had any relatives. And he was born and grew up, as all of my children were, in the Midwest, and didn't know my main family. So in order to, and I remember growing up here in Portland with nothing but relatives. Every week they loaded into the house to see my grandmother. And so I started here and got all the way back into the 1700s in Cumberland County with my family, and then started expanding it to see why they were here, where they had moved to, what was going on. But what is interesting is, and I believe me, Patricia is the expert on Southern Maine, but our history is British history. And so we talk about Roanoke, we talk about Jamestown, we talk about Plymouth Rock and the Pilgrims. And we really don't, in this country, we don't teach people about that much about, like, St. Augustine, because it was Spanish. And, of course, the Spanish conquistadors that ran across the southern part of the United States, because that's not British, so we don't teach that much. The first identified black in what is now Maine was Matthieu da Costa. And he was here in 1608, which is 12 years before the Pilgrims arrived. So we do have a long black history in this area.
And I read that if a black servant or somebody came with the earliest settlers, they would have been the first ones on shore pulling the boat up. So they actually were the first ones here.
In a lot of ways, yes.
Right.
I thought interesting, Da Costa was actually an interpreter. And he was with the group that some people may have heard of because the Lake Champlain was named for another member of the group that Da Costa was with. So those were the French. And, of course, our British history doesn't really want to talk about the French people that come.
Right. Well, I'm going to read a Facebook post from Melissa because it kind of touches upon this misconception here of basically no blacks in Maine. And she writes, "I've only lived in Maine for 9 years, transplanted Marylander. I love it here, but was initially shocked by the lack of diversity. When I invited a friend who is black to visit, her first response was, 'Are there any black people in Maine?' So, Bob, you teach others about Maine black history, and I bet you encounter this question a lot, that Maine is known as a white state, and people think there simply have been no blacks living here from day one.
We've been here all over the state. Since, as I said before, since we know 1608,
1600s.
Actually there was one black that died aboard ship, a Spanish, French ship that arrived in 1604. We don't have a name. So the first black that we actually know by name was Da Costa.
Okay, interesting. And then, Patricia, most of the stories you unearthed of blacks living in the Kittery area in the 1600s and 1700s were of slaves or servants, but how would you describe how their experiences were as far as what you learned through your research?
Could you ask that again just
sure.
a bit?
Sure. And maybe you can do this through an example, but you did a lot of research on those who were living in Kittery at that time, the blacks who were there, really were mostly slaves and servants. Is that right?
Well, the term servant and slave, I think, needs to be clarified.
Okay.
People are brought here as enslaved. And then gradually documents sort of, in quotes, soften the picture and refer to them as servants. But I think we need to be clear that their status, their situation was enslaved. And the earliest that I found as I was working along was 1660, when Mingo was sold to a tavern keeper in Kittery in the area of what is now Elliott. But it's possible that slaves came to the area earlier. In 1645, the man who was at the beginning of what's now the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, Richard Cutts, came here from Jamaica. And it's very likely that he brought enslaved people with him because 30 years later, they appear in his inventory, and several of them are quite elderly. So it's hard to know exactly when it all begins. But it begins to become much more noticeable as the time goes by.
And you said it's from the inventory. That's an example of the kind of way you could find out that there were a certain number of blacks in any household.
Sometimes. And that's one of the points that I keep trying to stress is the fact that there's so much uncertainty in terms of this whole field of information because things were poorly recorded. And so it's only happenstance that people might appear. In one document for a given slave owner, there might be a name for a given slave person. In their will, it might be just the person might refer to as a Negro or a mulatto. And so you can't even be sure whether you're talking about the same enslaved person.
So you did what you could with trying to figure out who was who.
That's where it becomes tattered, yes.
And you also mentioned the name Mingo. So there were a number of names given to a lot of the slaves at that time, and they didn't keep their surnames or they didn't take surnames. Right. So that adds to the confusion in keeping track of who was where.
In terms of naming, they generally had no choice. There are a few survivors of their African names, but most were just given some odd Phyllis or Pompey or Sambo. In fact, in Kittery, as I'm working along to add to the confusion, I had 8 Phyllises and 9 Pompeys. And so you get this great confusion of who's who and where are they and what is happening to them.
And that's, forgive me for jumping in like that, but that's one of the big problems in that none of the slaves or even free blacks at that time were publishing things. Mm-hmm. So the names used were the names that the white owners used. And that wasn't always their real name. That was just what the whites called them.
And certain names, like you said, were really common. It's just kind of curious, like why Pompey and why Phyllis?
Yeah, well, they were using things to do with the ancient history. It was kind of a joke in a way.
Oh, gosh.
excuse me.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about that after the break. We'll just take a quick break now, and we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from St. Lawrence Arts, where you can see it, hear it, and experience it live on Portland's Munjoy Hill, stlawrencearts.org, and Maine Community Foundation, where you can create your own charitable fund to benefit Maine. Learn more at mainecf.org.
An impeachment inquiry, transcripts, testimony, whistleblowers, oh my.
I believe that this matter is unprecedented.
Now, we've seen this movie before.
Like any mafia boss, the president didn't need to say, that's a nice country you have. It'd be a shame if something happened to it.
Okay, and I will say to my colleagues sitting here, I think you're nuts.
That's next time on The Takeaways Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRI.
That's coming up this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Our war on terror.
In the war on terror.
A justice.
Explosion! Oh my God!
Who's our enemy?
We've got to deal with whoever did
America
this.
America does not take strikes to punish individuals.
Who are we killing?
We're not just shooting away at people willy-nilly.
Members of a wedding procession.
Renditions, detentions, drone strikes, and the single sentence that guides them.
It's all been hung off these 60 words.
60 words.
That's the next Radiolab.
And you can hear Radiolab tomorrow at noon and Tuesday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, we are talking about the history of blacks living in Maine over the centuries. Joining me, Bob Green. He's a writer and he teaches Maine's black history. And Patricia Wall. She is the author of Lives of Consequence. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And joining us on the line now is William David Barry. He is an historian and writer with the Maine Historical Society. Thank you for calling, Bill.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here. Distinguished company.
Yes, indeed. You've written about the fact that the institution of slavery in Maine was perceived to be less harsh, even kinder, than in the South. Is that true, or is that a myth?
Well, that was something that was written in the 19th century. It was kind of a comb-over, I think. Kind of a it's a myth. In the early days, it was pretty harsh, and the Yankees from Maine were shipping slaves from Africa to basically the South, but also to the North. I think it was pretty rugged here in the early days. They were branding slaves. They were bringing slaves here. In later days, they kind of looked at, well, that same was done in the South. My old Kentucky home, that sort of thing. Slavery is slavery, and it was pretty bad. And you know, nobody covered this. Back in 1967, the NAACP put out a book, and they hired a historian to do a little history, and he wrote, "The history of the Negro in Maine is shadowy indeed. Until the 20th century, his presence, except for a few urban centers, was scarcely detectable." And basically, there were some things written about blacks in Maine or African Americans in Maine, but they were hard to get to, and nobody had really gone, culled them, put them together. And when I first came to Maine in the 70s, Jerry Talbot was the only guy that was working on it. And when I'd find things in the newspapers, the early newspapers, I would share it with Jerry, and he'd share things that I was looking for with me. and I was calling like our friend, Pat Wall was doing. There's all sorts of things in there, as she explained. You go through the newspapers and you find all these little things, but it's pointillism. It's not, broad brush stuff. It's little bitty things like so-and-so did this and that, and so-and-so was a minister at the Abyssinian Church, or so-and-so, a black person did this and that. And you have to really kind of pull these things together.
And you did mention... there are records of a few people, some stories that came out, and there was a slave who succeeded in working as a free man that I guess there was some stuff written about, known as Black Will. Can you tell us a little bit about his story?
Well, I wrote a little bit about Black Will, but I think I got part of that wrong, and I think Pat corrected me. I wrote in the... that's what history is about.
Right.
You find things and you write it down, and then somebody says, didn't get that quite right. And in Maine's Visible Black History, I talked about Black Will and Black Will Jr., his son. The original Black Will, and Pat can correct me on this, of course, started out as an enslaved person in Portsmouth, but then he moved across the line into Maine. And he bought his freedom and was able to buy a house, and was able to actually buy the freedom of another slave, just a friend of his. And he was well considered in the community. And of course, he was during the French and Indian Wars. He was on the line. He had his house was a militia post, or a place where people would gather when they were attacked. And everybody was happy about that. But then by the 1700s, the Massachusetts, which owned Maine, passed anti-marriage laws, saying that blacks can't marry whites, Indians can't marry whites, and mulattoes can't marry whites. But before that, there were no laws. But the original Black Will was considered, we're happy to have you there because you have a gun and you'll defend us. The second moved out of was whipped actually for marrying a white woman, and he moved up to Bailey Island, which was sort of out of the, beyond the pale, beyond the enforcement.
Okay, and also, I guess the end of slavery, or the so-called end of slavery in Maine, wasn't really clear-cut, apparently. Can you explain the kind of complicated story of how slavery was declared over in Maine?
That was very strange. They decided a black man who had been enslaved left because he heard that, the American Revolution had happened and all men were created equal, and he left, and his former owner took him back. And then the slave's friend decided, they pulled him back, and there was a legal case. And it was decided by a judge in Massachusetts who had originally been from Maine, and the judge said that it was called the Court Walker case, and he said no, all men are created equal, and there are no, because of that, he said slavery never existed in Massachusetts or Maine, and it was kind of a pull a rabbit out of a hat. Well, slavery had existed in Maine for a long, long time. Go ahead.
Can I add a note here?
Yeah. Please.
I think what was interesting was that the contemporary historian Belknap pointed out that when that judge instructed the jury to essentially find in favor of Walker. That Belknap noted that the public really paid little attention. If you search, you won't find any broadsides or any public notice that slavery has come to an end. And he quoted one man who said, "Well, they'll have to come and take away my property. Hmm. I'm not giving it up."
Right.
And you'll see year after year on the records, the tax records, that there is still that paragraph that the owner of slaves is still responsible to pay taxes on their enslaved people. Hmm. And that box on the form continued right up until 1800.
Right. So custom superseded law, really. I mean, the law wasn't followed by people on the ground. So they just went along with what they did. The other thing is, of course, some people just let their slaves go, and they were too old to work. And, you know, that was sort of Social Security. So you'd been working for somebody all your life, and you just said, okay, go away, which was pretty bad. You know, you expected if you'd worked for 50 years for somebody that they would, give you shelter and food and that sort of thing. So this whole thing was pretty rotten, what happened in Massachusetts, because it was, yes, you're free, but, you know, and people didn't pay attention to the law. And, and nobody's really written about this. Somebody with, you know, some legal historian should really, really look into this.
Okay. Well, that seems to be an ongoing theme. That stuff isn't covered that thoroughly. But thank you for explaining that complicated situation, Bill. Bill Berry is a writer and historian with the Maine Historical Society. And Patricia, what you were just saying, I'm just curious. You've implied there's really been some denial of Maine's involvement in slavery.
Well, I think at the time when they first are writing those American histories, abolition is underway at the beginning or in the first quarter of the 19th century. So politically, a historian who's going to really lay out the facts or even find the facts is going to have a difficult time getting it published. So most of those early histories have done their work, and their damage still exists today because they blamed anything to do with slavery on the South, and New England were simply the good guys who were favoring abolition. And so much of it gets just hidden. And also, as I mentioned earlier, the problem of looking at the records and seeing a man's financial situation after he died when he appears wealthy, you have no idea in the earliest years whether he starts out very small time and manages somehow to get an enslaved person to help him along. And often that was foundational, especially in the earliest years, in the early 1600s, when they're breaking ground, essentially, in southern Maine. And a young man, if you take a minute to take a look at his situation, he gets property, and if he can manage, and it was common to purchase things on credit. So he would have this small increment change in his life because suddenly he wasn't responsible for everything on his property. He had an enslaved person, and it meant that it freed him up to do another kind of business. And if he managed to acquire an enslaved person who was skilled, and that was quite common for New Englanders to ask around to buy an enslaved person with various skills, and he could either gain money by renting out his enslaved person, or, he could increase his own business by training his enslaved person to his leather works or his blacksmithing or that kind of thing.
Hmm. Okay, you know, we're trying to cover the whole history of blacks in Maine, so I'm going to fast forward a little bit now to after the Civil War ended.
Oh,
by that
you gotta,
time.
Wait a minute, you got to go
over.
Back.
Oh,
the
go
Revolutionary
ahead,
War was a key bit, especially for Maine and northern New England. We have right now in Portland, for example, there are three black Revolutionary War soldiers buried in Eastern Cemetery. And that doesn't include people like, I got to look at my notes here, Tobias Hill in Brunswick and London Atis up in Machias. So There were a lot of blacks that participated in the Revolutionary War that came from Maine.
Mm-hmm. My book has a long list of men who served in the American Revolution,
mm-hmm.
And that was just in that particular part of Maine.
This was fighting for freedom, and one of the
sure.
weird parts about it was one black who was a slave of Portland's eminent minister, Mr. Smith, when he went to war to fight for his freedom and Smith's freedom, Smith took half of his wages while he was fighting, and then didn't want to give him his freedom when he came back.
Yeah, that was common, yeah.
Well, moving to when there were blacks working as free men, what were some of the occupations they had in Maine?
Well, there were a lot of farmers, as you would expect. The other thing, and this is one of the problems with today, because when you look at a map, it doesn't seem possible. But Bangor and Brewer were seaports, as were Augusta and Hollowell, and so there were a lot of sailors and mariners and people involved in the sea. Here in Portland, the bulk of the black population in Portland, and we'll say 1840, 1850s, were people that either went to sea as seamen, or worked as cooks or stewards aboard ship, or were coopers or other things, other occupations that did work on shipping,
mm-hmm.
Longshoremen, for example, and that type of thing.
Okay. We have a Facebook message from Zanata. Remember to mention the restoration of the Abyssinian Meeting House in Portland and the family supporting that project. It is rich in history of not just African Americans as a national treasure on the historic register, but a vital part of Portland's history and the families, both black and white, that supported it and depended on its support. It is a living history monument right under our noses, with people affiliated as direct descendants as part of its history. So, Bob, a segue back to you there. I was planning to talk about the Abyssinian Church and how much of a centerpiece it was for the black community.
Yes, you called it a church.
Oh, well, that was it a place of worship as well as others?
Well, yes and no. It started off as a meeting house, the Abyssinian Religious Society. That began when a group of black men, including Reuben Ruby and Christopher Christian Emanuel and John Siggs, and I think there were two or three others, wrote a letter to the Eastern Argus complaining about the fact that blacks were members of churches here in Portland, specifically the First Church, but they were forced to sit upstairs in the back, although they had to pay the same amount for their seats as everybody else did. And so they broke away and started the Abyssinian Religious Society. They built the structure you're talking about. And later on, an Abyssinian church held their services in the building. And eventually, the Abyssinian Religious Society gave the building to the church, but also gave them all of its bills, too.
Yeah. Okay. I think just as well known as part of Black history in Maine is the rather horrifying chapter in Maine's history about Malaga Island in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And Patricia, I wonder if you can kind of summarize the rather dramatic story that happened there.
Actually, I can't. I'm not knowledgeable about that.
Okay.
I have been so focused.
Oh, yeah, you're immersed in your research. Well, that's fine.
In that part of Maine, yeah.
Let me just say this, that there were, people like to call them triracials, in that they were whites, blacks, and Native Americans involved, and they were married. But that's not the story they got into the newspapers. It was sensationalized at a time, and this has to go back further into history, but the Civil War did something to this country that people don't seem to realize, and that was it made a middle class. And so for the first time, people that lived in hot cities had enough time and money to leave in the summer, and go where it was nicer. And so you find these places that were built all up and down the coast, including Newport, Rhode Island. That's where the real rich were able to go. And others went to places like Black Point Inn here in Portland, and to places on Cape Cod. They looked at Malaga Island as a perfect place to put in some type of thing for the New Yorkers and Boston people to sit. And so that's why they had a problem and wanted to get the people off. And they did. They forced them off. The government, Maine governor, came in. And in 1912, I believe, they forced them all off the island and sold it to somebody who ended up never going.
So rather ugly chapter, unfortunately, in our history. We're going to take another quick break. We will be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Fallbrook Woods, a Maine-owned assisted living community in Portland supporting the unique needs and individual styles of those with memory impairment. And Bar Harbor Savings and Loan, committed to supporting their community by contributing their time and talents to area nonprofits.
Two different narratives are coming out of the House of Representatives. On one side of the aisle,
when you read the transcript, there is nothing there.
And on the other,
the smoking gun is already out. It's in plain sight.
I'm Ari Shapiro. As Republicans and Democrats battle over the impeachment inquiry, we'll look at the next steps for the investigations this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up today from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Climate change is causing a migration north for many species, including lobster, and that's forcing fishermen to think about the work their children might do.
Hopefully the lobster resource will still be strong, you know, when they grow up, and that will be there, and that will be an option, but there's certainly no guarantee that's the case.
This week on Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll also meet a climate migrant fleeing southern heat and hurricanes for the cooler climate of New England. Please join us.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are learning about the longtime presence and contributions of blacks in Maine over the centuries. Joining me, Patricia Walsh. She has written a book about blacks in southern Maine in colonial times, and Bob Green, a writer who has done extensive research on black history in Maine. Please join the conversation. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to read an email from Alex. He says, I have been researching a very well-respected free black fiddler, Jack Douglas. It is said that he served in the British military, possibly as a drummer boy, in the late 1700s. He owned property in Frankfort, now Winterport, where he is reputed to be buried. I'm trying to find out more about him and trace his children that were recorded in census records. Are there any suggestions? He may have come from Cape Verde, but he apparently first came to New London, Connecticut, sometime in the late 1700s. Any information for Alex?
I would suggest that he contact the Black Heritage Trail in Portsmouth. Mm. Valerie Cunningham is most interested in the topic of musicians, black musicians, in the 18th century and 19th.
Great. Okay, thank you. And there's an email from Kate. Historian Dr. Kate McMahon at the Smithsonian's Museum of African American History and Culture is currently researching Maine's involvement in the illegal slave trade. Ships built in Maine, ships captained by Mainers, all actively trading slaves. You aware of that research?
Oh, yes. And in fact, it was illegal, by the way, to captain a slave ship. And the only captain that was hung was from Maine, Captain Gordon, and found guilty and was hanged for piloting a slave ship. But Maine was big in building. We're talking wooden ships.
Mm-hmm.
Maine was huge in building wooden ships. And we were very big in putting out men that ran these ships, the captains. So slavery, in a weird sort of way, was very big in Maine as far as money was concerned.
Hmm.
Plus, you also have to remember that there were insurance companies of the day who insured these ships. And so they were making money, which is the reason why during the Civil War there was a strong sympathy, especially in the Portland area, for the Southern causes.
I'm going to fast forward again to the Civil Rights Movement here in Maine. What did that look like here? Was there a lot of prejudice? Were there a lot of protests and activists here?
We did have activists here. One of the biggest ones was Gerald Talbert.
Yes.
Who became the first black to be elected to the state legislature. And he served two terms from Portland. He's a native of Bangor.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother, Robert Talbert, was the first executive director of the Maine State Human Rights Commission. So and his daughter right now, Rachel Talbert Ross, is now currently serving in the state legislature. So the family has been very strong.
Very significant. And in fact, I think USM just recently created a fellowship in honor of Gerald Talbert.
True.
And I is establishing that fellowship in part to document black history. And
that's
so his
true.
Legacy.
And interestingly enough, Jerry's wife, Anita, is her maiden name is Cummings. And it's her brother who started the restoration of the Abyssinian,
all
Leonard Cummings. And so, and his family currently, one of his daughters, Pamela, is now in charge of the restoration.
Right. And I know that your research found that all the few families in Portland have all got great connections and have
done
great things.
Yeah, but both of them happened to go with school with me. We were all in high
You're
Portland
connected
high
to everybody. Great. We have a Facebook message from Kate. LD 1700 is this most recent session of the Maine State Legislature directs the State Department of Education to study how to best teach Maine's black history in our schools. It's written and sponsored by Rachel Talbert Ross. While the bill passed its committee, it did not pass through the full legislative body. It's a missed opportunity. So thank you for that message, Kate. We talked about Gerald Talbert and other well-known Mainers who are black. And there was also Reverend James Healy, the first black Roman Catholic bishop in the country.
Yes, and he was here at did very well. He spoke French and was very strong with the French-Canadian population coming into Maine. Interesting family. He was born, I believe, in Louisiana. His father was Irish. His mother was a black slave. They were very, very light-skinned. And I'm not sure if any of the people in Maine at the time he served actually knew that he was black. I think they thought he was Irish. But his brother, one of his brothers anyway, was president of Georgetown University.
Yeah.
A sister was the first black mother superior in Vermont. They had another brother who decided not to go into the priesthood and instead became a seaman and captained a ship in what is now Alaska and in a service that is now called the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard today has an icebreaker called the USS Healy.
Ah, so this ongoing theme that there has been an impact of all these black Mainers over time. And even we've skipped through the centuries here. We're here today. We have many communities of new black Mainers, many of them coming from different countries in Africa in the face of strife and oppression. And that includes the recent arrival of asylum seekers. So how different are these new black communities from those who came before?
It's, I don't really know. I've talked to them. Actually, we had two different courses at the University of Southern Maine concerning the new arrivals. And they have just the same problems that everybody else had, except they never had to worry about the slavery.
Mm.
And theirs is a little bit different because of language skills and that they're not allowed to immediately go into professions in which they have studied and have become proficient, such as being doctors or nurses or stuff.
Speaking of communities, mm-hmm. By the way, Black Will down in Kittery,
who Bill
was the
about.
Founder of the first black community in Maine in 1696 when he buys his property for £25, which he had earned apparently all on his own while he was still enslaved. He buys this 100 acres, and it's near, it's central in Elliott. And over the time, other black families came to settle in that little area, and it was a small enclave, and it survived up until about 1836. But most black communities that formed after enslavement is gradually ending had a tough time because they were not welcome. So they found places at the edges of town and oftentimes were not welcome to travel from town to town, mm-hmm. but had to stay pretty much where they were.
Okay, we have a Facebook message from Marilyn. Don't forget Pompey Russell, buried in Weld, Maine. He fought in the American Revolution at the Battle of Bunker Hill, marching with John Stark from New Hampshire to just slightly over the New York line to the battle. I have an article about Pomp in the March-April 2015 issue of Your Genealogy. So one of the other folks whose name went down in history.
Oh, yes. There have been plenty from Maine. The first doctor in the state of Maine is believed to be a black man.
Mm-hmm.
Macon Allen was the first black attorney in the United States. He was admitted to the bar here in Portland. He later became the first black justice of the peace in the United States in Boston. Robert Benjamin Lewis, who was born in the Hallowell, Augusta area, lived in Bath, ended up dying in Haiti, but he wrote the first Afrocentric history of the world. So there have been a lot of, strong black people from Maine that have put their mark on history.
So this is the big question that you need to answer in 10 seconds. Why is it important to learn about the history of blacks living in Maine?
I personally think it's important to learn the history of Mainers, despite what their color or anything or ancestry.
I feel it's that great missing piece. It's that great hole in our education, learning about enslaved people throughout the colonies. And I just can't urge teachers enough to make use of the resources to start in the earliest grades to alert children to the presence of African Americans and their contribution. They weren't just simply victims here. They contributed their skills, their knowledge, their wisdom. They came bringing a lot of things to our country that unfortunately go unrecorded, but certainly deserve to be a part of American history. As one person has said, African American history is American history.
Yeah.
And any phase of American history that you approach, you're going to find the contingent or the part that relates to the African presence.
Okay, well, thank you, Patricia, Bob. Thank you both for joining us today. Patricia Wall is the author of the book Lives of Consequence, and Bob Green is a writer and contributor to the book Maine's Visible Black History. He teaches Maine's Black History at USM's Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Sandra Harris took your calls. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. You can find links and resources and recordings of past shows at mainecalling.org. I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Have a great weekend.